welcome to the Bardolatry Podcast. This episode, we are one person short. Olivia, our third member, had family circumstances and couldn't make it. Also, it's snowing and she couldn't drive in from Maine. So today you are just stuck with two of us. I'm Gavs.
I'm Katie.
And we decided that we wanted to just talk about one play. So kind of hearkening back to our Titus Andronicus episode, we decided to talk about another play that we hadn't read. So we settled on Love's Labour's Lost, since none of us had ever read that before. Just to give you, I guess, a tiny little bit of background based on the very tiny little bit of research that I did. It's one of Shakespeare's earlier comedies, and it's also one of his more obscure comedies. I read that it apparently was fairly popular when it came out. I was going to say aired, but I don't think it's quite right. But,
was first performed.
Yeah, because some of the political stuff in it was fairly timely, I guess. After that sort of blew over, people weren't as interested in it anymore. And it basically didn't get performed again until, like, the 1800s. So, it's kind of interesting that we're reading a play that apparently, like, no one ever watches, but...
Well, I can kind of see why after reading it, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, so... Love's Labour's Lost, I guess, also just a really, really quick summary. It's four dudes, including the Prince of Navarre, who decide to swear off of everything, including women, for 3 years, and just live pious, studious lives. And basically immediately after they make this vow, four women show up, including the Princess of...
France. I think France, yeah, like Normandy, like I think France is still very much divided,
yeah,
right now. So
the four of them show up and they meet with the men, and of course all the men immediately fall in love with all the women and people say very witty things to each other. That's basically what
that is. The play. This is like Love Labor's Lost is like the Seinfeld of plays, because of Shakespeare's plays, because nothing really happens. Like, that's it. That's the play.
I would say it's a fairly accurate description of that. I love that comparison. It was interesting for me to read, because when it first started, I remember Act 1, I was, like, laughing. The dialogue was pretty good. Mm-hmm. I liked the repartee. But then as it went on, it kind of started dragging for me. I was like, okay, can the wit stop for, like, 5 seconds?
Yeah, that's kind of funny, though, because it's very, well, at least it seems very short until you get to Act 5, but yeah, we'll get to that later.
What did you think about the wit?
Well, I have to say that there's some stuff in here that, like, Shakespeare, I know I posted a Facebook status about it last night, but Shakespeare was really ahead of his time on some of these, like... Basically, the entire play is people making sex jokes at each other. Yeah. Like, that's pretty much it. And there's one part where, yet again, we have another Rosalind, because, you know, stock names, Rosalind, Catherine,
Antonio.
Like, you know, that's what we've got here. And so she's telling off that she's saying... And I quote, this isn't someone, like, making up Shakespeare rap lyrics. She says... Thou canst not hit it. Thou canst not hit it, my good man. Like, literally hit as in, like sexually. So, yeah. That's, like, Shakespeare. You can thank Shakespeare for, like, all of those I'd hit that. Like, you can thank Shakespeare for that.
Yes, that is apparently a 400-year-old phrase. I was cracking up because when I saw your status last night, I definitely thought it was, like, someone making up Shakespeare rap lyrics.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't gotten to that point yet, and then when I read it today, I was like, oh my god! That's incredible.
So, yeah, we have a lot of, you know, it's pretty much witty banter, and I think I'll bring up the point that even though, like in, you know, As You Like It and Much Ado About Nothing and the other romantic comedies, all the witty banter ultimately... amounts to marriages in the end, but this play is interesting in that the main couples don't end up getting married. They're self-aware of that, like, wait, this is and how this is supposed to end. I think the Brown's like, Jack shall have his Jill, And then they say, like, oh, the play can't end now, but it's like, oh, but, you know, according to, like, the laws of play, it must take place at the same time and place, and there we won't see them again for, like, a year, so, oh, no, yep. The play's ending.
I was going to say, that's one of the things, I guess, I was going to say one of the most interesting things, that's not fair to say, but one of the interesting ways this play is different from other comedies is it's definitely comedy.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't end in marriage, which is basically a rule or a definition of comedies. We've talked about how, like, in As You Like It, how couples just seem to randomly get married off just for the sake of the comedy. And, yeah, in this one, I think pretty wisely, the princess is like, hey, my dad just died. I need to take a year and, you know, figure that stuff out. And almost, I don't know, it almost felt like they were acknowledging, hey, we've known each other for, like, 2 days, so maybe we shouldn't get married yet.
Yeah, maybe we should, you know, wait a year, like, actually in a realistic time frame.
It's just, it's ripe for sequels. I'm kind of surprised I've never seen a sequel.
Well, wasn't there supposed to be a sequel called, isn't there, like, a lost sequel? Like, don't people think that there's a Love Labors 1 and that it's, like, lost to time somewhere? Or
that's very possible. I don't actually know. That sounds right, but now I don't know if it's because you suggested it or...
Yeah. Or it could be very much like the Avatar The Last Airbender movie where there was supposed to be a sequel and people didn't like the play, so the sequel was never made. So...
This is like the first demonstration of a box office flop and the story never got resolved.
Yeah. I mean, there is good stuff going on here, like with the witty banter. And I do have to say, I thought Rosalind and Brown kind of reminded me of Benedict and Beatrice a little. Like I
was going to say that too.
So they kind of had that going on there. So I found their relationship the most compelling. Mm-hmm. So there was some really funny stuff in here that I would love to see performed, but there's just no substance. There's, you know, all these fools and these learned men that just kind of come out of nowhere. And it's like, okay, like, what are these guys supposed to be doing other than pointing out that this Spanish dude is an idiot? Like, and then they come and they do this play at the end so, you know, the fool can get his revenge on the Spanish dude.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, okay, this is not, you know, like, this is not what I asked for. Like,
that subplot felt...
Yeah.
Extremely unnecessary. And I know that Shakespeare loves having, like, the highborn versus, like, you know, the common folk thing going on. I know we say, and I know this is something else we say every time, how, oh my gosh, I bet if you saw this performed, like, you know, these certain things would come through. But especially with this play, there were certain passages where I was reading, and I honestly probably wasn't always reading as carefully as I should have been.
Same.
And I had the thought, like, oh my gosh, this would probably be way better if you had some actors who, like, really knew what they were doing with it.
Yeah.
And it would be way funnier. But the other thought I had, particularly with, and I don't remember the character's name, like, Holofernes or something like
that?
Yeah,
like, he was one, like, the learned
and
men.
He basically spoke 50% in Latin.
Yeah.
And the particular version I was reading, like, didn't have the translations. And I was like, I don't know what the heck this dude is saying, and I don't really know how that works on stage if, you know, you don't have the translation, or if it's just like, haha, this dude is speaking Latin, and...
Well, I think for Shakespeare's audience, they would not have, you know, if they were lay people, they wouldn't have understood Latin either, so I think Shakespeare was just inserting basic Latin, because my book did have the translations, and it was very basic stuff. And so I think he was just inserting basic Latin as kind of like a ha-ha to, like, the common people, like, oh, you know, these are learned men, but they're really just speaking very basic Latin, like, because he can get away with that since the common people don't. No. Yeah, and I was kind of trying to see if I should interpret them. I'm like, are these really smart guys? Because they're obviously picking on Armado and saying he's stupid. So obviously they have to be wittier than him. But I'm like, are these guys supposed to be idiots too? Because they're just, like, superfluously using Latin and just, like, I don't know. I just kind of felt like, okay, there are definitely some jokes that, you know, if I read this more carefully and, like, looked up every, like, translation of some words, then I'd probably have a better understanding of it, but I was trying to figure their purpose out.
Yeah. I don't know, after having seen that production of Twelfth Night, I was just like, these dudes are like the Toby Belch and Andrew Agucci characters of this play, and they're supposed to be ridiculous, and that's how, like, I went with it, but they don't even pop up until, like, a little bit later.
Yeah, that's the
thing. So, that's another weird thing. The whole other subplot that I thought was interesting was, and I don't know how to say her name, but Jacquinetta?
Yeah, yeah, and... Okay, so, side note, apparently Jacquinetta means, like, some sort of thing that has to do with the toilet, but...
Oh, okay.
So, her name is clearly a pun because Shakespeare loves making fun of, you know, the peasant folk, but whatever.
Yeah, anyone who thinks that, that Shakespeare is highbrow, that dude freaking loved his puns.
Oh, God, yeah.
For real.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but I still can't get over, so last night we went to go see a production of Twelfth Night that was a bit, unconventional, as you should say. It was very wild. There was stripping and dance parties and musical numbers that went on and audience participation. And at some point, some guy brought in pizza for, like, the revelers on stage. And this older couple, all dressed in their best black attire, they just looked so offended. And they got up and left. And I just kind of found it hilarious because when people think of Shakespeare, they think of, like, the highest theater. And it's... Really? Like, it was lewd stuff back then. Like, Shakespeare, like, yeah, he wasn't highbrow. Like, this was, like, ha-ha. I mean, yeah, you do have the deeper stuff like Hamlet and such, but his comedies are, like...
Well, I mean, the reason that he has stuck around for so long was because he was so popular, and the reason he was so popular is because the common folk loved his plays.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're not gonna love his plays if it's all, like... boring academic nonsense that, you know, they don't care about. So, yeah, definitely, like, even in the very serious tragedies, you always have, like, ridiculous scenes
of comic relief
being absurd. Like, in Hamlet, I've seen, like, the grave diggers. He just, like, can't resist it. But, yeah, in this play is, like, I don't know, it's pure madness. It's, like, if you just take... all of the most ridiculous parts of, like, all of the comedies and slap them together.
That's a great way to describe it.
Yeah, he didn't really bother to, because one of the things about, like, his later comedies, I guess Twelfth Night, not necessarily the production that we saw last night, but it does have some of those, like, more serious romantic or, like, even hints of, like, tragedy in it. So even though it's funny, it still has, like, serious elements that kind of get you to be grounded. And this one, like, never really bothers with that. Like, I would say, having finished the play today, I'm, like, not even sure that I could name all of the characters for you. Because their personalities were not distinct enough from each other.
Oh, God, yeah. They didn't have, for the most part, they didn't have distinct personalities at all. And I think that's kind of the point.
I was reading something that said this came out around the same time, or maybe, like, a year or two before Midsummer Night's Dream, and in some ways, like, as we're saying, you know, that Rosalind and Byron, or however you say his name, Byron...
I thought it was, like,
Byron.
Brown.
They kind of are, like, a Beatrice Benedict type, and then at the same time, like, all eight of these young lords and ladies...
Yeah.
Are almost like a dress rehearsal for Midsummer Night's Dream, with, like, the chaos of the four main characters in that.
Yeah.
It's like he used Love's Labor's Lost, and then he's like, oh, you know what, I can do something kind of similar to this, but let's, you know, drop four of the characters so that the four I have left can get fleshed out a little more, but...
Yeah, a dress rehearsal for his other plays is a really good way to describe it, because... And this might be a good time to talk about the Much Ado About Nothing mashup, because I definitely saw some... It was, like, a less refined Much Ado About Nothing, because you have... Now we have slightly more couples here, but you can draw the similarities, like, where, I guess, Hero and Claudio are, like, the prince and the princess, and then Brown and Rosalind are, like, Benedict and Beatrice, and then you have... Hero's two waiting ladies, and then you have the princess's other two waiting ladies, and then the other lords that accompany Benedict, and then you have an evil Spanish dude.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so what I was telling Katie is I read that someone did a performance, I guess based on the idea that, you know, there should be a Love's Labor's one that does not exist or is lost to the world or whatever. So they did kind of like a double feature back-to-back showing of Love's Labor's Lost and Much Ado About Nothing, but then renamed Much Ado About Nothing, Love's Labor's One. Mm. And apparently, like, actually worked really well. Mm. And the critics said that kind of balanced each other really well, and you could kind of start seeing, like, the relationships between them once you had them back-to-back. So that's what really got me started thinking about, like, where are the similarities in these plays? And I think we've talked about before how Elizabethan playwrights all borrowed from each other and borrowed from themselves. And I think this play is a good example of that. You kind of see the seeds of a lot of comedic stuff going on, I guess with the exception of the weird no marriages at the ending. But
yeah, and I wonder, like, part of me wonders if Shakespeare was trying to break away from the tropes, because what he usually does is that he'll take a trope, he'll subvert it, and then he'll bring everything back to the status quo at the end of his play. But here at the end, he just completely subverts the trope and doesn't bring things back to status quo. So it is very interesting that we end a play with kind of these women getting the better of these men, and they're just left to sit there saying, well, that's the end, that's the play. And I was wondering if Shakespeare was trying to be edgy or was just saying, I wonder what would happen if I did this, would this be popular?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, perhaps it wasn't because it wasn't the ending that people were anticipating. I don't know, but I, as, like, from a modern day standpoint, like, I kind of enjoy it that it doesn't, you know, end up the way that the rest of his plays end up.
Yeah, it's satisfying that everyone doesn't just get, like, paired off and then they're like, okay, the end. We're happy now.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that. One of the things I definitely... So, one of the... I think, Katie, you mentioned this a little earlier, how, like, acts 1, 2, and 3 go by super fast. They're not that long. 4 is longer, and then act 5 is crazy long, which is unusual. In my experience reading Shakespeare plays, acts 4 and 5 usually are not the longer parts of the plays. And act 5 was ridiculously long, and there's all this stuff happening, you know, the lords, like, dressing up like Russians, and then you have them coming back, and then these kind of comic relief characters coming in, they're gonna put on a play, and then they have a song at the end. And I remember when I was reading Act 5, I was just thinking, like, this is what happens when your play has no stakes.
Yeah.
You just kind of keep throwing madness into the field until it ends. Because I seriously think it could have just kept going on forever,
Then
Shakespeare's like, oh, let's just bring in an attendant to say that her father died so we can end it.
That was the weirdest thing. It was like, I don't want to, it's not a cock block per se, but it was just kind of like, oh, yay, happy reveille. Oh, yeah, your father's dead. Oh, okay, well, we have to end the play now.
I also liked it how the messenger came in and was like, princess, it's about your father. And she was immediately like, oh, he's dead? I was like, did you... like, kill him before you left? How do you have... That's your first guess, is that he died? Is he sick? What's going on here? But, yeah, because the play is just so much, like, wit being thrown back and forth, but there's really... You know, I guess there's, like, the vague thing of the dudes are going against this vow that they made to, like, remain separated from the women, but that's basically it. Act 5 felt super draggy for me personally because I was like, I don't really, like, yeah, I can kind of tell that they're all just, it's going to end happy because nothing that serious has happened. But then that made me lose interest because there wasn't, like, any sort of drama at hand. Like, I wasn't worried about something happening or not happening.
And that's what happens when you have too much stuff going on because, like we were saying earlier with all the plays being mashed up together. It's like, you have the woman, like, hiding, you know, hiding their backs and pretending to be someone else, like, the end of Much Ado About Nothing, and having, you know, the guys be completely oblivious. You have the play with, like, you know, the comic relief characters, like Midsummer Night's Dream. You have, you know, the misunderstanding with, you know, giving someone the wrong favor, like in Merchant of Venice. So you have, like, all of, it's like, you have too much going on. So when you have too much going on, and you stuff it all into the very last scene of the play, it just feels too crowded. It's just not evenly balanced.
Yeah, and you have, like, the commoners putting on the play within the play, like, in A Midsummer Night's Dream, also, but not as funny as the one at the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream, in my opinion. And I thought the most random part was when they're like, okay, like, you know, my father died, wait for a year and see if you're still interested, and they're all like, okay, I guess we're gonna part now, and then the dudes are like, wait, we have a song, and then they randomly sing, like, two verses of a song, and they're like, I'm pretty sure, like, Armada's just like, okay, we're done now, and then the play ends. It's a really bizarre ending.
Yeah. I mean, the song might have just been, like, it's kind of weird that after everything is so non-standard, they sing a song, because to me that seems very standard. Like, okay, the play's ending, we're gonna sing a song now. But it's I think that's weird because it comes after all those tropes being subverted, and then they're like, oh, but we're gonna sing a song. And it's like, okay.
Yeah,
are you gonna stick to the convention? Are you not gonna stick to the convention? But back to it, just the play just doesn't feel very well balanced because when I first started reading this, I'm like, oh, this is gonna be a quick read because like each act was literally like only one or two scenes, and then you get to Act Five, and Act Five, Scene Two takes like forever. So it's just kind of like I wonder that like when they found like. I'm curious to see what the first folio of this looked like if the scenes were divided in the same way, because I just find it hard to believe that someone would consciously choose to divide the scenes in this way and just make it so unbalanced.
Yeah, I was not a fan. It's one of those things, I think, where, like, once you get to the ending scene, you're kind of expecting stuff to wrap up and the play to end. And in this case, you get towards the end and you know it's coming, but then it just takes so long to actually, like, finally get there. I almost feel like Shakespeare should have taken this into a writer's workshop and someone could have been like, yeah. Okay, dude, like, let's cut something out here.
Well, I think that's, as you were saying, this very much felt like a draft for Much Ado About Nothing in Midsummer, so that's probably how we got those plays.
Oh yeah, and the other thought I had when you were comparing it to other comedies, there is a scene where first you just have one guy on the stage, like, talking about being in love, and then the second guy walks on stage and the first guy hides and listens to the second guy talking about being in love. And then the third guy comes on stage and the second guy hides and both of them listen to the third guy.
Yeah.
And then the fourth guy. And that reminded me of Much Ado About Nothing about Benedict and Beatrice hiding while people were talking. Although in this case, like, they don't actually know people are hiding and listening to them. But I was like, oh my gosh, does this have to happen with every single one of them?
See, I think that could be hilarious. Like, that's the thing. Like, I think this would be hilarious performed. But I don't think many people choose to perform it because there's not as much renown behind it, and there's really not a main juicy role. Like, you don't have, you know, I feel like, you know, someone, like, a lead actor, like, this is very much an ensemble play. There's really no main character, so I feel like for very seasoned actors, you know, there's really not a lot of juice and meat to work with here, so I feel like that's why it's not performed as much, because actors, you know, aren't really aspiring to be, you know, the King of Navarre, or, you know, the Princess, and, or, you know, it's, they're not.
Yeah, I had the same thought while I was reading it. I was thinking, like, okay, what role would you want if this play was performed? Like, what would you consider, like, the big name, like, marquee roles? And there isn't really one. Like, the princess and Rosalind get to talk more than the other two attendants, and the prince and Barone, or however you say his name, get to talk more than the other two lords, but yeah, there's not like one central relationship really driving the plot as much, so.
Yeah, I just, my book has a breakdown of like the major parts with the percentage of lines, and Barone has the most with 22%, and then the king is next with 11%, so I guess he's the biggest role, but then like everyone else, the king has 11%, the princess has 10%, Dart Armado has 10%, You know, it's very well balanced between everyone else. So I will say that there are probably proportionately more female characters in this play than most of Shakespeare's other plays. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of surprising, like I was saying from earlier, from like a feminist standpoint, this play, like, it ends with a woman like not getting married and just kind of making a fool out of the men. So in a way, it's kind of one of Shakespeare's more progressive plays in a strange, like, I can't believe I'm saying that, but like in a strange way it is.
Well, yeah, because it's about these dudes who like are like, we're going to be manly and focus on scholarship instead of women. And then they just go, like, girl crazy, basically, and are, like, trying to woo these women who are totally just messing with them the whole time. Yeah, and then they all have the upper hand at the end when they're like, nope, come back in a year if you still love me, and then we'll see.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, in a way, definitely. And it is more well-balanced, so... That is interesting. They get to be just as witty as the wittier even the men.
Yeah, well, what I admire about a lot of Shakespeare's plays is you do have these witty female characters, you know, like Rosalind and Viola and Beatrice and Portia, but then at the end, you know, everything goes back to the status quo, and, you know, usually in those final scenes, the women are very silent all of a sudden when they're handing off for marriage. But this, like, I like how this doesn't end with that. Mm-hmm. It ends with, you know, the ball being in their court.
So what we really need is a sequel to Love's Labour's Lost that's just about these four women, like, hanging out. And you find out that they, like, have been traveling all over the world, like, seducing men. And, like, all the dudes are showing up, like the her dad is dead is actually just, like, a ploy they use to leave places. And they have, like groups upon groups of, like, suitors showing up to try and marry them, and they just reject all of them.
I can see it now. You have Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy.
And then, like, yeah, at the end, like, the prince and all his people show up, and they're like, nah, we didn't really like you that much either. We did this, like, 10 other times. It's just what we do for fun.
I like that interpretation.
So, I just remembered that I wanted to talk about something about the Jacquinetta subplot, like, a while ago, and then we got distracted by talking about puns, because apparently her name means toilet or something. Yeah. So, at the beginning of the play, and I don't know if this was just, like, my bad reading comprehension, but at the beginning of the play, it's talking about how... What's-his-face is getting in trouble because...
Oh, Custard or Custard or whatever, yeah, the hell is... Yeah.
Because they, like, found him, like, hanging out with her, and you find out, like, Armato loves her, and so he gets, like, this Custard guy gets punished, and then Armato's, like, trying to woo her ridiculously. I actually really did, like, the love letters that he wrote, because they were just so freaking absurd, but... At the end, I was really surprised to find out that she had been impregnated by Armato.
No, she was impregnated by Custard.
I thought he said, the baby is yours, to Armato.
Oh, but in Act 1, Scene 1, Custard, like, talks about, like, makes all these, like, sexual jokes about, like, how he, like, had sex with Jacquinetta. So I assumed the baby was his because he talks about having sex with her in, like, the very first act.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. That's where I got confused because, like, I got this impression that they were, you know, having sex with each other, and Armato is, like, just pitiful guy. And then he's like, oh, Jacquinetta's pregnant, and I was like, cool. And then he said something about, like, how the baby was Armato's.
And Where is that?
Let me see.
Because the final song is also about being cuckolded, so I interpreted it as Armato was cuckolded, because that's, like, what the whole last song is about, but...
Let me see if I can find it. It might just be that I'm a terrible... I don't have any reading comprehension. Let's see. Okay. So, Hector, she is gone. She is 2 months on her way. What meanest thou? The poor wench is cast away. She's quick. The child brags in her belly. Already, 'tis yours.
And who is that?
Custard says that. It's right here. So, I didn't know... I thought... That meant that Armato was the father, and I was kind of confused why Custard was like, haha, like, sick burn on you.
Yeah, that's, again, that's something, like, I didn't have a chance to really absorb it either, so I just interpreted that our motto is just being, like fooled and cuckolded, because the whole, like, last song, like, there's a lot of, like, stuff about being a cuckold and stuff, but, yeah, I guess I would have to do another reading of that.
Yeah, I would want to read some more about that. The Wikipedia article claims that our motto is the father, but, again, like, I don't know, so... That's, I guess, our big question. If someone could help, please answer that. Because I was under the impression that, like, Coster and Jack Winnetta were, like, a thing. And then, like, our motto was just ridiculous. And they were making fun of him the whole time for being in love with her, including her. She's like,
yeah,
whatever, man. But then he's like, oh, yeah, she's pregnant. It's yours. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's... So maybe Coster's the one being cuckolded? I don't know.
Yeah, that part's... apparently a bit confusing. So Shakespeare, maybe workshop that a bit and bring it back in for another for another session. And I guess that's basically our big thing. Like we said, there's not really a whole lot of plot going on, so there's not really a ton more for us to talk about. So I think we'll go ahead and just end the conversation at that. I guess, actually, before we completely end the conversation, I would just say, Katie, would you recommend that someone, I guess, read and or go see this play performed?
I think this play would be a lot better performed than, like, actually reading, because it's really just a bunch of wit, and I can guess right now there's probably a lot of physical humor in the actual production, so, there's a lot of funny stuff here, but I think it's a lot better if you see it perform. So I would definitely see this perform, but I think there's a reason why this is one of the lesser performed plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the language is just, like, so dense and quick. I felt like I was just missing stuff when I was just reading it. So I agree that if you had the option, I would think that going and seeing it would be a way better than just reading it, because reading it, it just starts to, at points, get like, what? Especially that ridiculously long scene in Act 5. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the one other point I wanted to bring up is that this play boasts the longest word in any of Shakespeare's plays. Ooh, in Act 5. Fact. It's like a ridiculously bastardized Latin version of honor. It's like honorabilis. I have no idea how to pronounce it, but just in case
you know, like, line number?
I don't. I think it's Act 5, Scene 1, and Coster says it. I remember that.
Okay.
But I will include it in the summary of the episode, just so everyone can see it. Just a fun fact about this play. And the other fun fact is that it also apparently has the longest speech of any of Shakespeare's plays.
Hmm.
In Act 4 somewhere. So.
Oh, yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
So, yeah. And I guess
with
that, we'll pretty much consider our discussion wrapped up. Hopefully next time we'll have Olivia with us. Just so you know, Birdolatry is part of the Minerva Podcast Network. I don't know if that's necessary to say. I don't know where else you'd really be finding us. But, just for fun, our website is www.minervamag.com. You can find us on Twitter, @MinervaMag. You can also find us on Facebook. If you have anything you want to add to the episode, you can leave a comment, you can tweet us, message us, whatever. And you can also give any suggestions for future episodes you are interested in. We would be happy to talk about basically anything. And our podcast schedule has changed slightly. Instead of podcasts every Thursday, we've currently reverted to putting podcasts out every Wednesday. So not that big of a change. Hopefully it won't ruin when you listen to this. And I guess with that, we will bid you adieu. So bye, everyone.